you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for... I was pretty astonished at getting this prize, and I'm sorry I wasn't able to come here when I was supposed to have done. Might have saved my life by not coming. Anyhow, I'm here now. And I was asked whether I wanted to give this talk earlier in February or in March, and I suggested now because I've just come back from the Far East and I thought I'd pick up some tips about what I'm doing, but not very much has progressed, so we haven't moved a great deal further. Now, what is astonishing about this whole game is its fertility. I mean, after all, when studying an algebraic object, and it's just a finite set, and it's led into all sorts of areas, and very surprisingly, the places where it's led have been new, and results have been discovered which were not known to the people who ought to have known them. And this still goes on. So if you discover something new, you don't know whether you've made a contribution to the solution or you've made it more difficult to solve the problem. When I entered university, I went to a talk, and the gentleman told us all that we should be classified not by what we know, but by our ignorance. And that's very much the case here. I can talk about many things at a very shallow level, and these things, you need to know quite a lot of mathematics to put these things together and make a story out of it. So let's see how it goes. This is the title. There we are. Now, at the top, you have an example of what somebody said. Maybe you can tell me who it was. It was Siegel, perhaps, said, not sure, that mathematics, apart from general theories, needed some nice examples. So there you have Peano's theory, and you have an example. Now, I noticed this, I'm not quite sure under what circumstances. There's a book by Duval I had been reading. He has an expansion of the J function, but he has it all wrong, doesn't have these numbers in it. But there is a paper by Atkin and Swinnerton and Dyer talking about non-congruence groups, which has the expansion correct, and I expect at the time I was looking at that. Anyhow, that I don't quite know. Now you can say, well, that's pretty hazardous to make anything out of that because that's just one number. Well, in fact, although that was my initial observation, that the number on the left is a coefficient in the Fourier expansion of a well-known function, and the number on the right, the larger one, is the smallest complex dimension of an irreducible representation of the monster group. At that time, I did have other information, or shortly after that, because my wife had been computing the irreducible representations of the Lie group E8 over the complexes. And if you take, roughly speaking, the cube root of the J function, you get a similar sort of moonshine with E8 as you do with the monster. Anyhow, I'll come back to all this in a minute. Finite simple groups, well, say something about them. Quantum logic, there's a certain congruence relation that turns up here, and it ought to turn up somewhere in the physics that was done by von Neumann before the war, and there are people who pursue this sort of axiomatics, and I can't find it anywhere, so it's probably new. And there may be variations on it which might be important from a group theoretical point of view. Replicable functions, these are the functions that we get by axiomatizing the properties of the J function. Dispersionless flow, I'll say a little bit about that because I think that this is where we might get some clues as to how to construct a manifold conjectured by Witten to be related to the monster, 24-dimensional spin manifold. And if I'm lucky, that's the date. So that's a good philosophy. And I'll say more about that at the end with respect to the natural numbers and in connection with some thinking diagrams, if we have time. People ask, what is monstrous moonshine? It was invented, the name was invented by Conway. The story was that I made this observation I mentioned earlier and wrote to Thompson in a letter about something else that this looked to me worth investigating. He wrote back saying that I was reading tea leaves, and he was at Princeton at the time, and he and Fisher were there, and they Fisher got his daughter. I don't know how old she was. She's probably not yet a teenager, but anyhow, fairly young, to investigate a bit further. And they were surprised that indeed there was something going on. And then they went back to Cambridge. Conway was there. Simon Norton was away at the time. And in a very short time, there was a lot of work done on describing this phenomenon called moonshine, and that's in a paper in the Bulletin of the, I'll give you the reference later. First of all, I'd like to give you a toy example for those of you who are not at all familiar with this game. I should say right at the beginning that if you're going to study moonshine, I think it is an exceptional object that you should be looking at, and although you might be able to develop some general theory, it's probably only in very, very special cases that things are really interesting. And I'd like to imagine that there's just one special case, which is the monster, and that's really the most interesting case. So let's look at what would happen if we were to try to construct moonshine for a nice little small group. We have a non-abelian group of order 6, the symmetric group on three letters. We take the two-dimensional representation. We look at the characteristic polynomial. All these characters are rational so that we can refer not just to the element, but we can refer to the cyclic subgroup that they generate, the element generates. And we have this function, it's purely arbitrary, but just chosen, and we can make an expansion of this as a Q expansion here. So these, this is the Fourier expansion. Well, it's not a Fourier expansion yet, it's just the expansion here, and these are the coefficients. So you get 6Q to the fifth, and this is a coefficient of that, and so on. And you notice that the rows that I've written down are characters. The first one is the first irreducible, the second one is the second irreducible, the third one is the sum of the first two, and fourth one is easily recognizable, and so on. And in this particular case, you have a block of six, and then by adding 600, you get all the other blocks. Now, that's not true in general, but for the moonshine game, what I would like to observe is the fact that this is a periodic sequence, period 2. This is a periodic sequence of period 3. And if we replace these numbers by their sign, namely plus 1, minus 1, or 0, this is periodic period 1. So if we replace the entries in here, the coefficients, by their signs, plus 1, minus 1, or 0, you get periodic sequences which are related to the orders of the elements. This property does hold in real moonshine and hasn't yet been proved. So less naively, to get some modularity into it, you can work with these functions, and these are recognizable as connected to the Dedekind eta function here, which is this function given down here. That's all very classical, and it's a simple exercise in symmetric function theory that these functions will have the same properties, same sorts of properties as you've already seen. So that's a very trivial example, and what happens is that we have a bunch of classical functions. The prototype is the elliptic modular function J, and we will study the group by generalizing the identity function. I don't recommend this for other groups. You can't usually get very far by starting off with the identity and trying to generalize it, but in this case you can go quite a long way. So let's the main aim, I think, the long-term aim is to do something like to unify the classification of the simple groups. And at the moment we have essentially, let's forget about the cyclic groups of prime order, that's for the number theorists, the prime numbers, and then we have the Lie groups, Lie Chevalier groups over finite fields and their fixed point subgroups. There's about somewhere about 18 families of these things and 26 other groups, and the 26 other groups, classical ones, are the groups of Mathieu in 1861. In his paper in 1861, he describes the two small groups. The subscripts are the degrees as permutation groups. So you have permutations of degree 11, 12, 22, 23, and 24. These groups are well known to be associated with the Steiner systems corresponding to them. M21, if you were to put it in there, is the group PSL 3, 4. And these groups are highly transitive. M24 is five-fold transitive, and M12 is five-fold transitive. And they exist really because the alternating group on six letters has an unusual automorphism structure, and from that you can build up M12, and from that you can build M24. So these are the classical sporadic groups. The word sporadic is due to Burnside. He was a very smart man. He made very sound conjectures. At the time, for example, all the simple groups were divisible by 3 and even, but his conjecture just said that they were even. So he was very careful. Anyhow, he makes this remark in his second edition of his book that these apparently sporadic simple groups would probably repay closer attention than they have yet received. For an amusing remark, although Mathieu wrote this in 1861, he said he found them all. In 1873, he wrote another paper to describe the big ones, which he said his friends had some trouble with. In 1898, G.A. Miller wrote a paper trying to prove that M24 didn't exist. So that's interesting. That's 1998, that's 37 years after they were discovered. And then he published a retraction in French. He didn't publish anything else in French, but he did publish his retraction in French. So if we move on quite a while, from 1861, if you like, to about 100 years later, Janco did a lot of work on finding sporadic groups, and he found 4 new ones. In 1964, Janco discovered this group called Janco 1, subgroup of G2 of 11, and subsequently discovered some other groups. These numbers indicate, well, he's got Janco 1, there's a Janco 2, Janco 3, and a Janco 4. Now, the significance of this monster group, which was discovered in the 80s, and the way these groups were all discovered is essentially the same sort of way that particles were discovered in physics. You make a guess, you guess some properties, and then you sit down and try to prove something. Usually what you do is you make some assumptions about subgroup structure. You use those assumptions to construct a character table, deduce other properties from the character table, try to prove uniqueness of the character table and uniqueness of the group. So So that was all done. I think the first possibility of this monster existed in about 1974, and it was finished by Grice in a paper in Invenciones in the early 80s. And all of the 20 of the 26 sporadics are quotients of subgroups of the monster, and there are six others. These have been given the name pariahs. These are the six. The three other Yanko groups, Lyons, Onan, and Rudvalis. This little group, J1, has order 175,560, and the order of the monster is a little bit bigger. And the Tits, I think, calls the J1 the little dwarf. Anyhow, this is the order of the monster, and the primes occurring, the 15 primes, are what are called supersingular primes. They're just 15 supersingular primes arising from supersingular elliptic curves defined over the algebraic closure of FP. And these numbers have themselves arisen recently in connection with moduli spaces of abelian varieties. Recent paper on that, and there are probably connections with some work of Gritzenko, but there's certainly no explanation at the moment of why these primes occur in this group. We don't know of any connection directly, other than a group theoretic connection which is essential to everything, and that is in connection with these functions. So I'm now going to talk about Riemann maps, or when composed with the exponential map, we get a Fourier series. Oops. So now the Q here is e to the 2 pi I z, and the z will be in the upper half plane. And I want you to remember this form because we shall be talking about this. I haven't got my pencils with me. Maybe I'll do that. Yes, I do. So this is very important, this general form here. And in most of the moonshine stuff, we will be putting some constrictions on the AKs. The ones we're interested in, the AKs, are rational integers. But in general, if you don't do that, the AKs lie in an extension, in a composite of quadratic extensions of the rationals. In other words, the Galois group of the rationals is exponent 2. We normalize these functions 1 over Q and 0 constant term. And the property that's really intriguing is that all the functions that arise have the upper half plane divided by the group which fixes F. This is a Riemann surface, compactified cusps, and this has genus 0. This property Thompson found pretty astounding. And he suggested that the whole phenomenon was really some 21st century mathematics, which had come along a little bit earlier than expected. So that this phenomenon, the genus zero phenomenon, and the fact that these are all classical functions is intriguing. Now, behind a lot of this, a lot of the computational side of it is Simon Norton, who's at Cambridge, and he has a very nice way of looking at these functions, and I'd like to describe to you what that is. We're working here with an ordered lattice, partially ordered set, and we have an equivalence relation on pairs. AB is equivalent to CD if the inf and the sup are separately equal. So what does this mean? It means we can take a pair A and B and construct the sup and the inf, and we can take another pair C and D and construct their sup and inf. And if these are the same, then that says these pairs are equivalent. Now this equivalence relation can be extended to a congruence relation on the lattice, and we shall be interested in functions which are compatible with this quotient structure. Now one thing that intrigues me a little bit about this is, well, first of all, it doesn't seem to appear in the physics literature, but also there's a slight bit of flexibility here, and it may be that one might be able to catch these pariahs by modifying this structure a little bit, but that's pie in the sky at the moment. So we say that two pairs are equivalent if the GCDs are the same and the LCMs are the same. And as a passing remark, if you think in terms of diagonal 2x2 matrices and think of this as a presentation matrix for an abelian group, then you're saying that the abelian group generated by A and B is the same as the abelian, is isomorphic to the abelian group generated by C and D. Now we come to another feature. One learns a lot by reading old mathematics. This is 1903, and the man called Faber, some of you may be familiar with his work in connection with univalent functions, he was posed a problem by Runge, Hilbert, and somebody else whose name begins with P, I'm not quite sure who, concerning approximation theory, and the solution involved these funny polynomials. So let me just say a little bit about the polynomials. One way of looking at them is, remember the form in which we have f. F is 1 over q plus these are our f's. So we can form a linear combination of powers of f and eliminate all but the most negative exponent in the q, and we get a polynomial in f. The reason why we have two subscripts is because the polynomial, the coefficients of the polynomial depend on f itself, and so we have a unique polynomial big F, and try pushing this thing. There's your F. We've got two subscripts here. This one tells you that the coefficients come from F itself, and you can see that down here. Here's the second one, F squared minus 2A1. A1 being the coefficient of Q in F. And we can form a linear combination of the powers of F, eliminating all the negative powers here except for this one, and we can take the constant term and put it into the left-hand side. So this tells you that this function is unique, polynomial is unique, and that these coefficients are unique. These coefficients are known as the Grunsky coefficients. They have an interesting history as well. Grunsky wrote about them in 1939, and they were used in early attempts to solve the Bieber-Buck conjecture, at least the small values of coefficients. So that's a Grunsky coefficient. I'll say more about them shortly. This is generating function for the Faber polynomials. If we make the convention that F0 is 1, and these are the other values, F1 is F itself, the identity map. And more generally, the Faber polynomials are the characteristic polynomial of this matrix here. Now this matrix has a special first column, and all the other columns are constant on the diagonal. All the rest of the matrix constant on the diagonal is this big 0 up here. And those of you who work in symmetric functions will recognize this. If we take these coefficients here, subscript shifted by 1, if we take them as the coefficients of a polynomial, of initial coefficients of a polynomial, then this, the determinant of this matrix is the sum of the nth powers of the roots. So this is a matrix known to the symmetric function people, and this is the property that the Farber polynomials have. Now, to say more about the Glinsky coefficients, well, I'll do that still in a minute. We have some sort of grading. HRS is the index is R plus S. We multiply these things together, we add the add these indexes. Now, this following remark down here is really astonishing, because it should have been known to the mathematicians a long time ago, and it wasn't. And it's nothing to do with the dimension of some space of modular forms. What Norton proved, and I'll show you how in a minute, is that when the Glinsky coefficients are compatible with Norton's equivalence relation that I gave you earlier on, then the HABs are polynomials dependent upon AK, and K is in this Norton basis, and Norton basis consists of these 12 numbers. So if you know A1, A2, A3, A4, A5, and so on up to A23, you know F. Again, historically, it's quite interesting that the recurrence relations that are satisfied to develop the rest of F are given by Mahler in a paper in 1974. And Mahler actually was aware of this potential connection with moonshine and wrote to me about it, suggested I should come out and see him before he died. And I went out to see him, and I got sick and had to come back, and then he died, and we didn't meet. But he did teach me. A long time ago, he was the professor who did teach the analysis at Manchester. So that is a rather remarkable result. Let me just show you why that is true. If we've got the picture here. Well, we need a little bit more. Well, I'll come back to that in just 1 minute. The name of the game is to generalize the J function. So the J function is the elliptic modular function. It's invariant under the full modular group. And if you take any Hecker operator, Tn, recall that what a Hecker operator does is it takes you from a lattice in the complex numbers and maps you to all the sublattices of index n. That's what Tn does. If you have a function on the lattice, you get an induced action on the functions. So here we have Tn of j. And for all n, because j has modular level 1, for all n, we have this statement here, and this is the Farber polynomial. These are the sums over the representative matrices, triangular matrices AB, 0D, where AD equals N. So we want to generalize this property, and to do this, we twist our Hecker operator and replace the sum over one function at different places by the sum of different functions. And this FA is just a label, and the A here is the same A as this A here. And we say that a function that satisfies this is a replicable function. It has the form of the standard function that I gave you earlier on. And this defines for us the same action as we had before, but we have to modify our Hecker operator in order to accommodate it. So let me just make this remark here. This is what essentially the property of replicability, what we call a function is replicable if it satisfies that twisted Hecker operator action. These are the Grunsky coefficients, and they are the coefficient of Q to the M in the nth Hecker operator, T hat M. What does replicability mean? It encapsulates the property that if you take the term in the sum with the highest value of A, that term is this, and then all the terms with the lower A occurring in here. So you get an inductive definition here. This has to be a series in Q to the N. So in other words, the nice functions under the Hecker operator are precisely the replicable functions. Since, well, I guess it's immediate from generating function of the Fabre polynomials that this is symmetric in the two subscripts, and, or from the definition earlier on, I guess. And here, if you take the Hecker T1, that acts as the identity, so that's just going to give you back the coefficient of Q to the M, which is AM. So this tells you that if you have HM1, you get AM. Now, if we come down here, first of all, it's convenient to write it in terms of H hat, which is R plus S times HRS, and these numbers are rational integers. The HRSs are not. So you get you compare the power of Q on both sides of the identity for the Fabre polynomials generating function, you get this identity here. And notice in terms of this index I was talking to you about, this is index R plus S, this is index R plus S, and each of the terms over here have index less than R plus S. And what we do is suppose we want to compute AK, then we have a choice of R plus S, so that R plus S minus 1 is equal to K. We free to choose R and S subject to that condition, and then we try to find R and S so that there's another pair, R prime and S prime, such that their index is lower, the sum is lower than it is up here. If such a pair exists, we repeat the process. If it doesn't exist, then we are on a line which you can't descend, which is essential, and we can take the term R plus S minus 1 to be one of the subscripts in the Norton basis. So let me just show you how that goes. So I've just written this down. So basically we're trying to get to the border here, and the border with the subscripts coming from the Norton basis, and the lines are all have the same index. Now, using the equivalence relation of Norton, we can say certain things like H23 is the same as A6, because H23, we take GCDs and LCMs, we get 6 and 1, and that corresponds to A6. So this is how it works. We want to compute AK, so we choose R plus S equals K plus 1, X plus Y equals R plus S, that's this line here. We try to find an R and NS on the hyperbola XY equals RS, such that there is an R prime and an S prime lower down. Then we repeat this process, and we'll end up on one of these green lines with A23 down to A1. This is, of course, very convenient for computing. And given tables, and we have tables for hundreds and hundreds of functions, given those 12 coefficients, you can actually directly compute, in principle, as much as you want on the function. But usually, identifying a function can be done from fewer coefficients because of the fact it lies in some rather small dimensional space. One thing that should be said, you hear about things, there's something called Grobner bases, and there's some variations on it. Well, I've tried to solve these equations on several occasions, and so has my colleague Clement Lamb, not Chris Cummins, and we never succeed. And we go along and ask someone who's an expert in this game, and they say you have 12 variables, and they just laugh. So although in principle you should be able to solve these, they're just polynomial equations in 12 variables, 12 seems to be too big a number to solve. But computers are getting better and faster, and people have thought of other ways of doing things. There are some alternatives to Grobner bases, and maybe we should keep trying every so many years to see if we could get a direct proof of determine all the replicable functions. We believe we have them all, but the proof is a local proof, and if we made mistakes, they would propagate. But there's some evidence that we have the right number modulo a lot of primes. It's probably correct. This is another way of looking at this twisted Hecker operator. This is the what's called the Atkin UP operator, and the VP one is the one that I'm really interested in here. So VP takes you from f of q to f of q to the p, and we need a v hat p in order to create t hat p, and that is really the composition of the standard VP with what you can think of as Adams or a Frobenius action here. So what it does is it takes you from f of q to f super p of q to the p. And in fact, you can say more than I've said here, but this is the coefficient, this is the nth coefficient of f super p. That you can write down directly. This preserves the functions mod p, so people who are working in modular functions would like that property. It's a little bit easier to explain this power map in terms of the monster. So suppose we're inside the monster. I should say the replicable functions with rational integer coefficients, there are about 600, just over 600 of them. Now, from the moonshine point of view, there are 194 classes in M, in the monster. Now, these, of course, are conjugacy classes of elements. We look at the rational character table, and there are 172 classes of cyclic subgroup. So this number is the one that we should be interested in if we're looking at rational moonshine. And for some reason, nobody knows, there are two classes of elements which give rise to the same moonshine function. So in fact, we have 171 functions which are monstrous moonshine out of this 600-odd which are replicable functions, all with rational integer coefficients. And this map that takes you from f to f super k is the map which, if you are inside the moonshine game, inside the monster, will take you from the element g to the element g to the k. So it takes you from the function f sub g to f sub g to the k. Now, the monster is a finite group. So given any element G, there will be some number K, which is the order of the element, so that F of G to the K is F sub 1, the identity, and that will be the J function. So we know that there's some K for any F such that this is a J function here. What is the conjecture about exactly what the replicable functions are? Well, they are either these things here, which I unintentionally typed as modular fictions. I think it's quite a good name. And they have the property that if C is one of these numbers 0, plus 1, or minus 1, then they are the exponential, cosine, and sine. And very surprisingly, you can actually say something from the monster you can learn something about these functions. Alternatively, they are, and I'm using the word principal moduli here, the proper word or the standard word is half-module, but it causes problems in plural in English, and I think principal moduli is quite a good alternative. With invariance groups, these are the groups of 2x2 matrices, which under linear fractional transformations on the convex argument preserve the function, so that this is a Riemann surface and it's a genus 0 Riemann surface and contains the triangular matrices mod n. N is the modular level. So these are the triangular matrices, 2x2 matrices, mod n. And you can actually say something about this, in fact, has to be contained in a Helling group, which is the normalizer in PSL2R of one of these gamma zero n's. And the property of these supersingular primes is that the genus of the normalizer of these gamma zeros, gamma zero of P, is zero precisely for these supersingular primes. Well, yes, when it's, that's right. The proof, one really wants to prove exactly what the replicable functions are, and some work has been done by Terry Gannon and Chris Cummins and Simon Norton, and certainly they've proved that the principal moduli with Q coefficients of rational integers are replicable. Now, the replicability property, you see, is basically a combinatorial property, and you've got to get some analytic structure out of that to go both ways. That hasn't been done. Okay. Now, I proposed at some conference that the monster was such a big thing, maybe we should think it was infinite and use analysis instead of algebra to study it. And this has actually proved fairly successful. So let me diversify a bit. This object is Schwarz derivative, which has this. This is one of the notations for it. It's a strange notation, but there we are. And it's a function of the derivative of the logarithm. What are we looking at here? Derivative of the logarithm of f prime. So f double prime over f prime. This is my definition. The physicists and many other people divide this by 2. If you want to know about this, you'll find about it in Klein's book on the icosahedron. And what you do, the property it has is if two functions are linear fractionally related, as these two functions would be here, then this provides you with an invariant differential operator. So actually, you just take this expression, you take logarithms and differentiate enough times to eliminate A, B, C, and D, and you end up with this identity. Now, what's interesting about the Schwarz derivative is that if you take a modular function of weight 0, which is what the functions we're talking about have been, then the Schwarz derivative has modular weight 4. And so we can if you like, we can take this bit out. F prime will have weight 2, F prime squared will have weight 4, so that leaves us with this function here. Whatever it is, it's going to have weight 0. But we know for a principal modulus, it generates a field of functions on the Riemann surface, and therefore this function here must be a rational function of F. So we're looking here at a rational function of this function F. This observation, you'll find it in Poincaré about 1909, a long time ago. So how are these things related to what we've been talking about? Well, the answer is that there's a very beautiful relation that Sabar and I found a few years back, which can be expressed in this form. I've done this rather funny way of writing it for good reason, but this is your Schwarz derivatives vector Q, and this is the sum that you can express in terms of these. These are Grunsky coefficients. And this zeta of minus 1, as all of you know, is the sum of the natural numbers, which is minus 1/12. And the reason I've written it like this is because there appears to be some connection with some work of a Japanese. And his work is related to a generalization of the problem of the elastica. And I don't want to go into that. I don't think I could say very much about it. But I'll tell you some interesting things. First of all, elastica, the word was used by one of the Bernoullis in 1691, and it's used extensively in books on elasticity, Timoshenko and Love. It's not in the English Oxford English Dictionary. So I wrote to them and told them it should be, and they do something about it. But the elastica problem is basically how do... Well, one way of thinking of it, if you have a metal ruler and push it in from the ends, it will buckle. How does it buckle? This gives rise to elliptic integrals. And that's one picture by James Bernoulli. And there's some other pictures here. If you're going to get Conway here in May, get him to bring along his metal band. He has a wonderful metal band, and he can probably make it look like some of these things here. So here's some. This is actually from Euler. So all these strange shapes are connected to the elastica problem, and the elastica problem is somewhat more general, but the functions that arise in the work that I'm doing are a genus zero degenerate case of some of this work that is done in Japan by Matsutani. I don't want to say too much about that more. Anyhow, that's the reason for this regularized function here. By the way, there's also a preprint by Lepowski on why zeta of negative integers should occur in expressions which derive from vertex algebras, but I don't know anything about that. Now, there's something called the dispersionless Hirota hierarchy. This is an integrable system. During my, I got hit by a car last year. During my recuperation, I sat looking through what you can do on the web, looking at all the papers with certain expressions in them. I think one can call this a research by syntactic similarity. And I found some interesting things here, and in particular, get this equation. And this is a slightly different game. This is a something called energy stress tensor, and the free energy and the tau function up here. And this is all well known to the physicists. It's also connected with Dubrovin's work. This constitutes a prepotential here. Now, the clues are such that I think that these two equations are related to each other, and one really wants to solve these things for tau. Now, going back, I mentioned in my title something about Witten had a manifold, and Witten's, I don't think he's written anything very much up about it, but there's a book by Herzebruch, Berger, and Jung called Manifolds and Modular Forms, and in that they suggest that certain invariants should come out to be the J function, and that is what should happen here, that the tau function should, I think, be the J function. Now, the trouble is, down here, we have very many equations, because we have these equations for each function, f. So if we're looking at the J function, hmn of J here. These are called local time coordinates, and one would like to try to solve these differential equations, and in some way, or rather, relate the hmn of f for various f coming from the monster to each other. And I don't see how to do that at the moment, but I think it's possible that can be done. So it's very much up in the air, but I think the clues are such that someone will eventually see how to relate this to this and relate and construct from this a manifold. The fact that it would be 24 dimensional comes from the fact that you have this Norton basis property. You have a bunch of 12 time variables and another bunch of 12, well, infinitely many time variables, but you have a rank 12 situation, and you have a conjugate one as well, and that together should give rise to this supposed manifold. Of course, this may be nonsense and it may not exist, but it's a nice thought. Let me just make one or two other remarks. So I'm leaving you up in the air there. Maybe someone here will solve that problem. The relationship between the Schwarz derivative and the Grunsky coefficients is really a generalization of Borchardt's product formula, which is down here. So Borchardt has this product formula for the J function. That was the first announcement of it. I'm not quite sure who it's due to. It's called Borchardt's product, but Zagier and Conan were involved in it at some stage or other. And you see, you can rewrite this in such a way that you can let P tend to Q, write this 1 over P minus 1 over Q, so you get PQ over J of P minus J of Q divided by P minus Q, and then take limits. And then you can play around with that and eventually get something involving the Schwarz derivative. And that will give you the relation I had on the J function, and this same thing works with slight modifications for the other replicable functions. Well, it would be incomplete to come here and talk without saying something related to Coxeter. So I'd like to make some remarks concerning the monster and thinking diagrams. Now, I don't need to write this on the board. Suppose you're trying to classify the symmetric group on n letters. It's generated by a conjugacy class of transpositions. Transpositions are the elements that move just two of the n terms, objects, n elements in the set. And if you take the product of any two transpositions, they lie in one of three classes. Either the two transpositions are the same transposition, in which case you have a product of order one, or there's a Ti and a Tj transpositions, and Kij is 1 if Ti is equal to Tj. It's 2 if Ti and Tj are disjoint, the moved elements, and it's 3 if they have a common symbol. So this is a property that the symmetric groups on n letters have, and you take a generating set of transpositions. Which these lie in. Now, if you do the same thing with a monster, they're not any longer transpositions, but you call them transpositions and put quotes around them. They're called Fischer transpositions. And what happens in the monster is, instead of lying in three classes, they lie in 9 classes. So let's see how to make that 9. 1, 2, 3, 4. We got under 5. Yes, they nine classes. And those are the orders of the KIJs. And with a little bit of work, if you want to see it, it's in the Moonshine Workshop from the CRM, which you've got upstairs here. You can identify the conjugacy classes of the product with the nodes of the affine E8 diagram. That I've done. And since by moonshine, each conjugacy class in the monster is related to, has moonshine function associated with it, every one of these products goes with a moonshine function. So here, this is the element of order 1, this goes with the J function. And there's an element of order 2 goes with the function, principal modulus for gamma of 2, and so on across here. Now the big question is, what do the edges represent? And the answer is, we don't yet know. So that's an open question, and it would be nice to know more. I can perhaps say, not very much more about that, but I will say something more. So that's the problem with the monster. It's connected with the affine E8 diagram. Perhaps I can put it in a slightly different context. If you take the group SU2, then if we take R to be the fundamental representation, we tensor it with a representation of dimension I, then we can write this down. And in the case of SU2, this gives rise to a graph. And this graph I call the representation graph. And in the case of SU2, there's one representation of each dimension n for each number n. By the way, if you want to do some really hard work, it's very difficult, very difficult. Classify the groups which have one representation of dimension n for each n. Just one. So this is SU2. Now if we look at some group G inside SU2, so when we tensor by this two-dimensional, R is equal to R2, we move to the adjacent nodes. And we take this to be the same as that. Now if we go down, let's say we go down to the quaternions, eight-element group, this remains irreducible, this two-dimensional remains irreducible, and when we tensor here, this becomes three one-dimensional irreducible representations when restricted to this group here. So if G is equal to that, this gives you, the initial segment gives you the Dynkin diagram, the affine Dynkin diagram. In the case of this, this is the group SL2. The E8 Dynkin diagram corresponds to the group SL25. If you do the same thing with E7, you can do just the same thing. You're working now with the group of the cube, and you have to fold it. So you take this diagram and fold it, because you don't want two conjugacy classes of order 1. And the critical property of all these graphs is they have maximum eigenvalue 2. So the 4 goes to a 2 and to 6. 3 goes to a 2 and to one of the 4s. So if we draw a picture like this, that will be the corresponding picture for the folded E7. And the relationship between E8 and the monster is the same as the relationship between E7 and the baby monster. Now the baby monster has a Schur multiplier of order 2, second cohomology group. If you do the same thing with E6, you get G4. And I guess you want the arrows that way. In that case, you get the triple cover of F24. This is a simple group, Fischer group. So one of the intriguing things is, why are these Schur multipliers the same as the fundamental groups, the weight lattices modulo the root lattices of these groups? That's an open question, but the existence of abnormally large Schur multipliers is really, to my mind, the reason why the sporadic groups exist. These large Schur multipliers occur as centralizers, or groups with them occur as centralizers of elements in further sporadic groups. And the monster has multiplier of order 1, so you can't expect to get a further extension of that. Here are some references. The Conway-Norton paper is the main reference for moonshine. The others are interesting connection with the connection with the Hirota game. I'd like to just mention one further remark, conjecture, which I find rather astonishing. I made it a year ago, and it is that the number of conjugacy classes in the monster and these three sporadic groups, in fact, seem to occur in some very deep aspects of physics. I think it's called F theory now. It was called string theory. And these numbers occur, the number of conjugacy classes in the monster occurs as the Picard number of a certain elliptic, associated with a certain elliptic vibration, which the physicists are interested in order to get a very large gauge group. And the construction involves 24 point-like E8 instantons. Well, if you do the same thing with point-like E8 E7 instantons, you get the number of conjugacy classes in one of these other sporadic groups I just mentioned. So there's probably something very interesting going on, but as to what it is, it's very far from obvious. It probably involves the some elliptic cohomology and something to do with Euler numbers for orbifolds. Anyhow, finally, let me end with this. I think this is a surprise to a lot of people, and the game. You must remember the Greeks, to whom the Platonic solids are associated, or with whom the Platonic solids are associated them with air, fire, water, the earth, and the universe. And this one is the universe, the dodecahedron, and it looks to me like what we have to do is to construct the monster from the dodecahedron in some way or other. And, well, that's homework problem. Thank you very much.